Accession number 27083, wheel 66.
So Henry, you said the loss of the Atlantic conveyor.
The loss of the Atlantic conveyor involved the loss of a number of helicopters, and their loss meant that the mobility of the land forces was quite significantly and seriously reduced. It was extremely difficult ground to advance over. It was extremely difficult ground to conduct an assault over, much easier to defend. And the forces did very well. I think I've probably said enough. I had not previously been to the Falklands. I went out a couple of years later. I didn't go out as soon as the war was over, because a lot of other people did. And it was a bit sort of gawping and so forth. And anyway, I was busy, as I shall come on to later, in picking up the bits and trying to extract the most I could from the decimations of the Not Defense Review. But I will consider that later with her.
Well, Sir Henry, this might be an opportune moment, given the hour, to stop today.
Right. Yes.
You asked me at the end of the previous tape, did I have some questions? Yes, I have a few questions. One or two you've touched on already.
Mm-hmm.
But if we may, we'll start when we reconvene with those questions and with your final observations on the Falklands.
Yes.
If we may.
Right.
Sir Henry, thank you for continuing with your contribution to the Sound Archive. We did leave the previous, our previous conversation with me about to ask you some questions about the Falklands before we move on to the conclusion of your period as First Sea Lord. But I think, if we may, you have a few additional comments to make about the structure of the MOD.
Yes, I have. On reflection, I think I rather misled you when I described the removal of the single service under Secretaries of State and the setting up of a new scheme, on the one hand dealing with people, on the other hand with things. And I'd like to get back to that because it may, I think, have conveyed something of a false impression. Under the new scheme, there was, of course, at the head of things on the political side, was the Secretary of State for Defense, and that was John Knott. Under him were two ministers of state, one for people, who called himself the Minister of State for the Armed Forces, and the other for things, who I think called himself the Minister of State for Procurement. And under, respectively, each of them was an Under Secretary of State, one, to each, for the armed forces on the one hand and procurement for the other. And that has a bearing on one or two anecdotes that I'm about to recount. And I think I left out that lower layer. At the time, of course, John Knott was the Secretary of State. The Minister of State for the Armed Forces was Peter Blaker, who was a nice man, quiet, and he did, you know, I've really nothing to say about him, but he was very sensitive to the political requirements of the moment, and very much a strict tower of the party line. His opposite number for procurement was initially, and he came from the House of Lords, of course, Ewan Strathcona, who was a most charming man. He, I think, would have been the first to have agreed that he knew very little about defence, but he was going to do his best. And he did it in a thoroughly decent, gentlemanly way, and we became good friends. But he was relieved, he was replaced after a year or so in office by Tom Trenchard, also from the House of Lords, who was rather a different kettle of fish and was a bit more truculent and a bit more, I don't think he knew much more. And at the risk of telling tales out of school, I will recall Ian Strathcona saying to me on one occasion, and by this time we'd become friends, and he said, "You know, what has really hit me very hard, was not the fact that I was I'm being replaced in this job, because I never did know very much about defence, and I've done it to the best of my ability, and that's that. But it is, who is replacing me?" And the idea that Tom Trenchard should know more about defence than even I do sticks in my craw, he said. And that was that. So that was an interesting introduction. Well, going on, lower down, the Undersecretaries of State, we've mentioned one already, who was the one for the armed forces in the form of Jerry Wiggin, a huge man with, frankly, no great intellect and no great feel for the business of the day, and was almost congenitally calculated to get it wrong. Now, that's a fairly damning thing to say, but I'm afraid it's true. And the trouble was that he was so plain dumb, frankly, and yet he had a streak of the bully in him. He knew he was pretty thick, but he was determined to stick to his guns and drive whatever it was through. And for my part, I was equally determined that he should not. Well, that was him. And we had, I suppose you could say, we had a personality clash. I'm not quite sure who didn't with him, because he was an extraordinary person. Who put him in? I've no idea at all. But they needed their heads examining. And then on the procurement side was Geoffrey Patty, who had been the Undersecretary of State for the Royal Air Force. And he was quite a sharp cookie. He was still quite heavily, I think, tarred with the light blue brush. But I'll say no more. At least he was intelligent, and he got things done, though not always to one's personal satisfaction.
How did the other chiefs get on with Jerry Wiggin? Did you ever talk about him?
No. But the unfortunate sobriquet that I had coined for him, Two Planks, it went all around the civil servants. And they thought it was a very appropriate one. I turn now away from that. I'm afraid that's rather a backtrack, but at least it gets the record straight. And I don't want to go on about Jerry Wiggin. You think that I'm constantly going on. I mean, we did have a personality clash, because he was so thick, and he almost invariably got it wrong. But I must quote two other examples. The first occurred at an Admiralty Board meeting. And at that time, board meetings, all three services, were normally chaired by the Minister of State for the Armed Forces, Peter Blaker. And so it was on this occasion. Also present, slightly unusually at it, but was Jerry Wiggin, Undersecretary of State for the Armed Forces. And one of the items on the agenda concerned the closure of Stonehouse Hospital down in Dumport. Now, traditionally, the minister, chaired the Admiralty Board meeting, and I sat on his right, and I think it was the Deputy Secretary for the Navy Department sat on his left, and then around the table were the other members of the Admiralty Board and so forth. And again, traditionally, although there was no ruling about this, but it was the custom for the First Sea Lord of the day to hold his peace until right at the end, and he had the last word, so to speak, before the chairman summed up and decided what was going to be done. And when it came to this item about the closure of Stonehouse, to my astonishment, Jerry Wiggin, sitting more or less opposite me, opened up in full flood, and he got it absolutely dead wrong. He said that Stonehouse didn't do anything, it was overmanned, it was entirely unnecessary, it was a useless bit of the defense real estate, and so forth, and it was high time that it was sold off. And I break with tradition, partly because this fellow irritated me so much, and partly because he was sowing the seeds of something which was fundamentally incorrect and wrong. And so I intervened, and glaring across the table at him, I said that he should know that if Stonehouse was disposed of, where would the current clientele of Stonehouse go? Traipse all the way from Devonport to Hasler in Gosport? Or would you rather they went to Chatham, which was still going then?
Further again,
and so forth. And I said, what you don't seem to realize is that in the armed forces, and this is not confined to the Navy, but in the armed forces, unless you provide and are seen and understood by the lowest member of those forces to provide the very best form of retrieval and subsequent treatment of casualties in a war situation, then your recruiting will go down and down and down, and you will no longer be able to enjoy the very high quality of men — we didn't have women then — in the armed forces. Now, can we please get on with the other items on the agenda and stop being so stupid? And he didn't like it much, but we got on. The Falklands War was now over, of course, and satisfactorily so, very. It was the norm for any chief of staff to do a 3-year stint. In fact, my Air Force opposite number, Michael Beetham — and I don't know how he got away with this, but he did — he actually did a stint of 5 years. This was not very clever. In the course of doing it, he totally upset the future plot, from which it took a considerable time to recover, but that was the way it was done. I determined to stay on for a few extra months, really to extract what I could by way of dividends from the result of the Falklands War. And in particular, I wanted to get tidied up in a responsible fashion the question of replacement for those ships which had been lost in the course of the war. Not those that had been damaged, but those that had been actually sunk. And I had a hard time in doing this, because John Knott himself was keen to replace on a one-for-one basis. And several of those lost had been Type 21 frigates, which had been procured in order to get gas turbines to sea that much quicker than through the normal planning procedures of the ship constructors down in Bath and so forth. And they were pretty well — not quite, because they were modified to some extent — but they were pretty well bought off the shelf. They were very popular in the fleet, but they had certain shortcomings, and we had lost several. But of course they were out of production, and it would have been absurdly expensive, poor value for money, to have replaced the Type 21s on a one-for-one basis, to have replaced them at all.
Can you just name a couple so people know what we're talking about? Would one of them have been Ardent? Would
that have been Ardent was one, Antelope was another.
These were two that were lost.
They were both lost. I think it was a third, I'm not sure.
What were Coventry and Sheffield?
They were both Type 42s, which were bigger, and they had Sea Slug, whereas the others had, they had Sea Cat, which was a short-range only guided weapon. And of course, the obvious thing to do by this time, we were beginning to roll off the production line, the Type 23, which they went for various names. I don't think they had a sort of name class, but they are a prime element of the destroyer force and frigate force of the fleet today, even. And I had some difficulty with John Knott over persuading him that it really was absurd to replace the 21s with 21s, which the production line for which had long since ceased, and so forth. We didn't really want any more of the 42s, which were bigger, much more expensive, and frankly, the main missile armament was already somewhat old hat. And therefore, we should skip them and go for the 23s. But it took a lot of very hard argument to achieve that. The question of invincible never really came up. And it's...
The sail-off.
The sail-off to the Australians. And in retrospect, it's interesting that it was never mentioned. I mean, she was mentioned as to what she had achieved in the Falklands, and this was mentioned in the House on various occasions. But the question of her impending, still impending, never cancelled sale, never came up at all. And I thought, well, I'm not a politician, but politically, I think it might have brought the government down to have continued with her sale to the Australians. And so long as the name Invincible did not come up, I kept my mouth shut. And that's all that was necessary. And it was just quietly slipped under the carpet, and nothing really was said. There was no positive decision to cancel the intended sale of the ship to the Australians. The Australians quite understood the problem and behaved very decently about it, and so on. But it was a curious way, to say the least, a curious way of doing business. And that's how it was done. Now, I'm not too sure about the sequence of timing, and it doesn't really matter. But when did the Falklands War end? It was June, I think, third week in June?
Third week in June, something like that.
Something like that. During the month of June, I don't think this is a regular annual event or anything. It was just a from time to time occurrence. But the Royal United Services Institute in Whitehall had arranged that each of the chiefs of staff, each of the three service heads, would give a lecture. And this was in the course of the month of June, and I think mine was probably the last lecture of the three, not least because of the Falklands War. This was, the content of the lecture was kept, it's an exaggeration to say, under wraps, but it was not publicized in journal or any other form. curiously, but this is the way they did it. It was not publicized immediately. It was publicized en bloc, so to speak, in, I think it was September, in the autumn. And so what you had said did not really get out. And as I recall, the what was publicized was the verbatim lecture that the service heads had respectively given. And of course, it was entirely free for the media to get the whole lot. But there were no leaks, and there was no slippage of snippets of information prior to that. And I decided, because this really was the end of my time, pretty well, but I was going to hold on for reasons I've just explained for a bit. And of course, the great juggernaut of the Defence Review no longer diverted from people's minds by the Falklands War, gathered momentum and was rolling ahead. And when I gave my lecture, I told the full truth and my opinion of what was being done. And I then forgot all about it until September came, when it broke and the media got it, in particular the press, and all hell was let loose. But there it was. I'd said it. I'd put it on the record. And there were my name featured in most of the broadsheets on a daily basis for the inside of a week, and so on. And the politicians didn't like this one little bit.
What did you say, Sir Henry?
I told the truth.
Yes.
As to what, well, I went precisely into what the Defence Review meant for the Navy, what the cuts would consist of, pointed out the folly of them in pretty well every case, and so on. This went down big, and the...
Of course, you had the massive moral authority of the Falklands.
So I did. I did.
To re-argue these points would have been would have carried tremendous strength and force.
Well, it didn't with the government, and it didn't with the Defence Review at all. And I was fairly desperate. So there was no question of the Falklands turning the Defence Review upside down, because the country, if you like, had effectively been saved by the Navy projecting the Army. Navy including Royal Marines, of course. One could go on like that forever. Anyway, this occurred in the... It was publicized in the autumn, and it was... it really hit the headlines. I've got scrapbooks full of the stuff. I didn't have to write them up myself. I just cut snippets in the various papers. And there we were. Despite all that, the Defence Review rode, like the juggernaut it was, it rode ahead. And I was absolutely desperate, because this was my last chance. And at the risk of boasting, I thought I had, to an extent, got the measure of John Knott and how he thought. I'm not suggesting for a second that I could dissuade him from the folly of his actions. And skipping ahead 20 years or so, when I met John Knott again, both of us long since retired by then, at Shrivenham, where they, Lord knows for what reason, they had a sort of... I forget what they called it now. Anyway, they collected all the chiefs and the such ministers as they could, and they replayed the situation at the time in terms of the and that was the agenda topic, the 1981 Defence Review. And John Knott became a friend. He was a totally different personality then. And he told me that he had to defend me to prevent the Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, from sacking me.
After the Royal United Services Institute
lecture? Yes, when that got publicised in September, which was... it was 2 or so months after the end of Falklands War. So that was quite interesting. It meant a slight sort of adjustment of opinion in my mind, not in terms of what John Knott was doing so much, as who was responsible for the folly of that ill-framed Defence Review. And there was a shift of emphasis that, unlike Francis Pym before him, and I've mentioned this earlier on, who dug in and said, this is folly, this is much too much, we're going far too far, and so forth. And John Knott was put in as the hatchet man, and that's exactly what he was put in for. And the Prime Minister really couldn't have cared less what he did, provided he coughed up the lolly, which he did. And John Knott, who was a highly intelligent man, he went on to be chairman of Lazards. And although one of my criticisms of him during his time as Defence Secretary was that he listened only to the advice he wanted to hear and not to really the service chiefs very much. And the advice that he was very happy to hear came from the most curious quarters, and I won't go on about that. Chief scientific advisor of the day was one. But he was, nevertheless, a highly intelligent man. And I'm told, this is hearsay, that when he took over Lazards, he never took a decision without consulting everybody. It was a complete fault for us. Very interesting.
You said that he was a different personality.
Yes, he was, whereas as Defence Secretary, and particularly during the Falklands War, he was tense, he was under stress, he was nervous, he was jerky, like the night that the Coventry was sunk and so forth. He felt that everything that occurred in terms of losses or mistakes that were made, and there were some, were one way or another his fault, which was a not irresponsible thing to attitude to adopt. But he was very jerky, and personal relationships were not warm, not at all warm in my case. Whereas 20 years later, he really seemed a different man. And he was relaxed, and he was charming, and hence he told me this, what I just recounted to you. Well, I won't go on about that. I turn now to the fact that as time rolled on, I got increasingly desperate with the fact that the Defence Review was almost set in concrete, the results of it. And I thought, well, all right, for the sake of the Navy, I'm in a no-holds-barred situation. And so I privately arranged a session with John Silkin, who was the Attorney General, I think,
You're thinking of John Silkin, the Labour MP.
The Labour MP.
Who was Attorney General
In Callaghan's government.
James Callaghan's government, yes.
That's right. Who I didn't really know. And I had him to dinner.
Quite a big bruiser of a man.
Yes,
if I remember right.
Yes. But intelligent. Nobody else present. And I had these little dinner parties or lunch parties in the Malhouse flat. With nobody else present. And I had him, I had Jim Callaghan himself, and I had David Owen. David Owen, I think, came to lunch. And Jim Callaghan, who was his usual genial, jovial self, we were sitting out over a cup of coffee afterwards when the telephone rang. And this was John Silkin to say thank you for his session, but he'd very much like to come and have another one. And I said, that, could I cut him off then, because I had Jim Callaghan with me. Oh, he said, well, give him my regards. And I did. And I turned back to Jim Callaghan and said, that was John Silkin, he's coming back for more, which I thought would not exactly weaken my hand, and so on. Well, the Callaghan interview, dinner party, took place on, I forget, it was the middle of the week, I think. And next morning, at 9 o'clock, my secretary put me through on the phone and said, Mr. Callaghan, we should speak to my secretary, from whom I hid very few secrets, if any, because it's never as important, knew what I'd been up to, of course.